So in this paper, I'm concentrating on the 7th century life of Patrick, written by the Irish cleric Tyrconn. And while my research predominantly deals with Ireland and the evidence from written sources, I hope to develop this work in the future and welcome any suggestions regarding the broader implications of the themes I'm going to address. So this is a focused analysis and is concerned with perceptions of conversion rather than realities of active conversion. Even so, I hope that it will lead to a greater understanding of some of the broader issues that affected the process of conversion in Ireland, particularly the changes that were taking place at a later point in the Christianisation of the island, and the crucial part that the formation of a specifically Irish Christian identity played in the development of the religion. This paper, therefore, deals with the construction of an appreciable and simplified conversion narrative that often lost sight of the details of actual conversion, some of the details that Roy has already talked about today. Even so, a deconstruction of Tyrconn's text will help us understand how details of real conversion were lost, thus shedding light on the ever-changing nature of the conversion process and Christianisation. Now, Tyrconn's life is often read as a propaganda tool for the patrician cult and the Church at Armagh to gain supremacy, predominantly because of the great number of clerics and churches who are associated with Patrick in the text. But this alone cannot adequately explain the complexities of the life. So today, I want to consider other, less overtly political motivations that must have inspired Tyrconn to write. I'm therefore going to focus on the ways in which Tyrconn creates a conversion story with Patrick at its core, and in doing so, establishes a new Christian reality and ultimately a new social order. Initially, I want to briefly introduce the life along with Tyrconn's methodology and his sources, and I'm then going to concentrate on two specific aspects of the text. The first is Tyrconn's harmonisation of conversion traditions using the frame of a developed ecclesiastical administration with Patrick at its head, and the second is the evidence we have for his own perceptions of conversion. By looking at the life in this way, we'll hopefully gain a clearer appreciation of how Christians in the 7th century came to understand their past and how this affected and shaped their Christian identity, which was ultimately still developing in the 7th century. So I just want to mention a couple of points about the work itself. It's a Hiberno-Latin life, which only survives in the 9th century Book of Armagh and was produced between the years 688 and 693. At some point, probably during that time. Tyrconn's life is one of two 7th century hagiographical narratives written about Patrick. The other was produced by the author Murucu, who also wrote towards the end of the 7th century. Overall, both writers adhere to the same patrician story, which sees Patrick as the driving force behind the conversion of the island. So it seems that by the end of the 7th century, a general narrative about conversion was agreed upon. Even so, each author's understanding of conversion and the past is unique. And in Tyrconn's case, the distinctive elements of the life include his rigorous and constant adherence to the role of church administration in the conversion of the island. The life itself is jam-packed with the names of ecclesiastical establishments, clerics, and converts, sometimes even at the expense of the narrative. But once you look past the catalogue of foundations and religious persons, it becomes clear that Tyrconn was writing for an audience or audiences that were interested in far more than just political aggrandizement. In fact, Tyrconn presents a multi-layered portrayal of the conversion story that, for instance, sees Patrick provide converts with alphabet tables as well as law and baptismal books, demonstrating that the writer and his audience were interested in the practicalities of conversion and the realities of the Christian life. Now, the life is structured around Patrick's travels, which see him visit the territories of the Inniel and Connachta. And as he travels, he performs miracles, founds churches, baptizes new converts, and consecrates priests and bishops, transforming both the religious and secular landscape. Most strikingly, particularly when compared with Murucu's life of the saint, Tyrconn has Patrick make a lasting impression on Irish social structures through these practical means. Undoubtedly, this telescope view that an extensive church administration existed in the 5th century is heavily influenced by Tyrconn's own 7th century experience. But it's also the case that the information and source material available to him played an important part in forming his perceptions. Now, I don't have time to discuss these sources in detail, but I want to make a number of points about Tirupan's methodology, as his use of source material is central to the construction of the life. So Tirupan refers to his dependence on particular sources on a great number of occasions in the text. And you'll find many of these on your handout. I've just given some selected examples that you can track as I'm going through them. Among other things, they include Tirupan's use of elements found in Patrick's Confessio, which you just see at number point one there. Although it's not clear that Tirupan actually had direct access to the text of the Confessio. What's even more evident from Tirupan's discussion of Patrick's early biography, however, is that many of the details contained in the Confessio have been expanded upon and reinterpreted by later audiences. Some of this reinterpreted material appears to have been handed down to Tirupan by his foster father, Ultan. So you see that at number two there. In addition to this oral testimony, Tirupan tells us that Ultan had a book about Patrick in his possession, from which Tirupan appears to have taken additional information. So that's at number three. Given Tirupan's repeated reference to Ultan's knowledge of the patrician cult, it seems likely that this book was written by his mentor, but we can't be certain about this. Moreover, Tirupan acknowledges the oral testimony of other elders, as well as the use of calculations made by numerical experts. So that's at number four and number five. Tirupan's evidential references not only stem from elite scholarly circles, but also come from the Christian landscape in the 7th century. In demonstrating the impact Patrick had on the island, Tirupan makes particular use of extant cult sites and objects. These include crosses, altar plate, relics, church sites, and more. So taken together, the variety of sources used by Tirupan reflects the great amount of accumulated material that existed for the story of Irish Christianity by the 7th century. What's more, it shows that the Christian history of the island was understood on many different levels, at an elite scholarly level, but also in a way which all Christians would have understood. Now, the way in which this array of material was used by Tirupan in his life is also of interest, because the majority of written sources are found in the first section of the work and associated with Patrick's travels in Inyale territory, while he makes most use of cult sites and objects in the second section of the life, which predominantly takes place in Connacht. So, the Confessio and reinterpretations of it, as well as information from Ultan, informed Tirupan's discussion of Patrick in Inyale territory, possibly indicating that this was an aspect of the Patrick cult, or the patrician cult, that was more well known, in elite scholarly circles at least. Rather strikingly, while Tirupan refers to three cult sites or relics in the first section of his work, he mentions 15 in the second, suggesting that he's more familiar with the Connacht landscape. Coupled with this is the fact that the chapters in this second section are lengthier and contain more developed narrative. So while it's possible that the stories associated with Connacht were not written down before, they are nonetheless comparatively weighty. In fact, the use of cult sites is indicative of the fact that many of these traditions were deeply embedded. As such, it seems that Tirupan sought to add further details to a seemingly well-attested written account of Patrick in Inyale territory by adding aspects of the cult in Connacht. As a result, he participated in the expansion of Patrick's written history so that it became one which could be understood within the value system of Irish society in the 7th century. And crucially, the commitment of new material to the written corpus shows that communities were still coming to terms with the religious changes that were taking place on the island. So having shed some light on Tirupan's intentions and methods, I now want to concentrate more fully on the information he presents in the life, specifically the great number of clerics that he includes in his text. Now, the evidence from Tirupan suggests that Patrick had already been incorporated into the history of countless communities, and his collection of source material indicates that a great amount of traditional detail existed which centred on Patrick. By pulling this diverse material together, Tyrconnell and those who preceded him significantly foreshortened the complex process of church development and consolidation that occurred in Ireland over many years, by pacing it all within Patrick's own lifetime. Consequently, these seemingly diverse traditions were placed within a coherent, if highly artificial, framework, ordered by a particular view of the island's Christian history. Thus, Tyrconnell's belief that Patrick was the main protagonist in the conversion of the island allowed him to incorporate a great deal of material into his life, even though associations with Patrick may have been slim. Now, at the beginning of his life, Tyrconnell includes a lengthy list of clerics, which contains four sections detailing the names of bishops, priests, the Franks who apparently accompanied Patrick to the island, and finally deacons. Now, it's not clear if Tyrconnell compiled this list himself or whether he actually copied it, but either is possible. Some of these clerics are referred to later in the work, while others only feature at this particular point. Now, this list appears to be a combination of several traditions, and it was probably created using the varied material that was believed to have originated in the conversion era. The individuals included in the list were probably early clerics, but could easily have operated in the 5th or possibly even the 6th century. Nonetheless, they became part of the patrician cult over time, and their presence in the narrative is indicative of the fact that they were valued as part of the conversion process. These individuals are vital to an appreciation of how Tyrconnell and his predecessors undertook the formidable task of bringing together this collection of diverse stories and melding them into a conversion narrative, a coherent conversion narrative. The great volume of clerics listed points to the complexity of the conversion process, as well as the number of individuals who influenced religious change. This complexity, of course, offers an explanation as to why a single cult dominated by Patrick and a single overarching cult presented in the 7th century was important. It was simpler, more accessible, and allowed Christians to understand their past in a way that probably meant something to them and dictated their own present. The archaic and possibly cryptic histories of these clerics are made accessible to Tyrconnell's audience through situating them within familiar institutional contexts, artificially backdated to the 5th century. While the biographies of most of these clerics do not survive outside of the patrician cult, a few select few are given special attention in the narrative, possibly because they were associated with enduring cult sites. For example, the cleric Asicus appears to have been a central individual around whom memorable traditions developed. And this especially seems to be the case because the life contains a story about the cleric that is independent from the patrician narrative. So if you look at points 7 and 8 on your handout, just at point 7 you just see how Asicus is placed within the patrician cult, and then at point 8 there you'll see how this story about him that really is quite unrelated to Patrick's story. There's a bit of a typo as well. At the very end it says the community of Columbkill and the community of Ardstrath claimed him. So just a little addition in there. So here Tyrconnell states that associations have been made between Asicus and the Columban community also, but Asicus's connection with the Patrick cult appears to be long-standing, especially because a number of the patrician relics Tyrconnell has personally seen were supposed to have been made by the cleric. So here we have an individual whose biography lived on, probably through his own community, and was expanded and developed through his association with notable institutions, who probably claimed him because of the endurance of his own cult. In addition, some of the clerics that are found in the text can be identified independently. For example, we know that the clerics Secundinus and Lomond, who are both mentioned on a number of occasions in the text, were connected with the early stages of Christianity on the island, as they're connected with early church sites, the early church sites of Dunshaughlin and Trim, respectively. What's more, the fact that Patrick does not baptise or consecrate these individuals might suggest that their connection to Patrick is tentative. So again, if you look on your handout, I think it's number 9 and 10. So in the case of Secundinus, we see Patrick travelling around the country, but in the case of Secundinus, he comes upon Secundinus, finds him under an elm tree, and then apparently there is a church or a cross there that commemorates this meeting or either one of the clerics. And then similarly for Lomon, again, he comes across him, so there's no consecration. So the connection between Patrick and these clerics appears to be an artificial one. Nonetheless, Tyrconn's aim to collect the traditions and stories of the early church means that elements of other cults found their way into his version of Patrick's conversion story of the island. Thus it seems that with the information Tyrconn gathered from many different sources, he created an account of conversion within the patrician framework, largely through association rather than replacement. And in this way, he manages to incorporate pre-existing traditions without compromising the monumental role that Patrick played in the religious transformation. Now, so far I've focused on Tyrconn's synthesis of extant stories and source material in order to create an extended life of Patrick and a singular impression of conversion. But it's also clear from the text that he had a particular view of the ways in which conversion occurred. And it's not surprising that Tyrconn's perceptions of conversion appear to be heavily influenced by the source material already discussed. Despite the incorporation of many elements into the text, Tyrconn creates a consistent impression of conversion throughout the work, and this is evident in a number of important patterns in the text. These are aspects of the Christianization process that Tyrconn gives special credence to and seem fundamental to his appreciation of conversion. So, as I've already discussed, these patterns include the creation of a developed church organisation, but even more specifically, there is a noteworthy trend towards the ordination of young children and the sons of converted men. Additionally, Tyrconn also believes that the acquirement of literacy is fundamental to Christian life, and he shows Patrick provide alphabets to converts on a number of occasions. So this overall approach is laid out at the very beginning of the life, and this is number 11. And here, this actually comes just right before the big list of clerics that I mentioned earlier. And here, Tyrconn just states that Patrick consecrated priests and bishops and wrote alphabet tables for them. And some of them he made bishops and priests who at a sober age received baptism. So in Tyrconn's estimation, the creation of a Christian hierarchy is fundamental. But it is important to the writer that this hierarchy is governed by a new generation, presumably because they were not tainted by a pagan past. This assumption is made most clear in his tendency to have Patrick consecrate the sons of the newly converted, rather than the first generation of Christians. From the outset, this is an aspect of the work, as Patrick consecrates the son of a convert at the establishment of his first church. So that's at point 12 on your handout. Immediately following this incident, Tyrconn relates the story of Benignus, Patrick's heir. Here, once again, it is Benignus's father that converts, but his son that becomes important within the ranks of the church. So that's at number 13. As Patrick's heir, Benignus is a key character in the patrician story. Crucially, Tyrconn establishes that he is untainted by any former pagan beliefs, as he is protected from a very young age. And I think it's also important here that Benignus states outright that Patrick is now his new father. So this tendency is found in various other places throughout the text. And I've given just one further example, actually, on your handout, which seems particularly extreme. So here we have an individual, Hinnu or Ineus, and he is converted. But nonetheless, it's his infant son who literally has just been born along the way. So it just says, he was born on the way coming with his father from the mountain. But it's his son, the infant, who receives the blessing of a bishop and also an alphabet. So a further element connected with the elevation of this new generation is Patrick's provision of alphabets. This is an aspect of conversion that once again was mentioned at the beginning of the life see in number 11 there. And it's something that he strongly links with the new converts and bishops in particular. In doing so, he places significant emphasis on the education of converts and their introduction to Latin, and associates literacy and Christian learning with the development and stability of the church. In total, there are 7 references to alphabets in the text. 2 are contained in the first book, while 5 appear in the second. Again, a situation that's not surprising, given the emphasis that on cult objects in the second section of the work. So the first is the general reference that we see in number 11 there to the provision of alphabets, but the following 6 describe how Patrick gives alphabets to specific individuals. Importantly, 6 of these 6 alphabets, 4 are given to the sons of converts, all of whom are consecrated as bishops. So Tyrocon clearly associates bishops and literacy with conversion and the development of Christianity. And these alphabets, as well as this new generation of Christians, are further examples of how Tyrocon has Patrick transform the spiritual landscape of the island. So today I've attempted to give you an idea of the complexity of this work, but the detail analysed has only scratched the surface. Tyrocon's portrayal of the 5th century is, of course, the result of his 7th century experiences. This is why he pays so much attention to cult sites and relics, highlights the role of a structured Christian institution, and has Patrick educate and preach to the Irish. But Tyrocon also manages to consolidate his own personal Christian experiences with the traditions of his elders, creating a fascinating hybrid whereby the past has significantly influenced his Christian present. Tyrocon's life is not just a work of political propaganda. It is a window on the complex ways in which Christian communities in Ireland came to terms with their past and the changes that were undoubtedly still occurring when Tyrocon came to write. Thank you.
Shall we have you both up at the table?
Get us some chairs, yes.
Yeah, some chairs would be useful. Thank you. Well, it's interesting, that pair of papers, because we have Liz's paper, which shows how the reality of conversion could be basically erased from the text, because texts have other fish to fry. And yet, I think Roy showed extremely well how texts can preserve... You want to sit in front of the table? It's much friendlier. So Liz's texts are erasing, and Roy's texts are nonetheless preserving enough that allows, I think, some very interesting suggestions about, in particular, how the arrival of monasteries would have changed the social landscape. So we've got lots of time,